Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, October 22nd, 2015. My goodness, only about 60-some shopping days till Christmas. Actually, I'm kidding there. I really, really get aggravated when I hear people say that. So I kind of say that as a tongue-in-cheek and not, but doesn't aggravate you that much. But anyway, I'm going to be talking tonight about oil and this concept of abiotic oil. Now, there's a lot of people that buy into that somehow oil is magically created miles, miles down deep in the earth. Big, big volumes of it. Well, there's a story to that. But where does real oil come from? I've already said it comes from comets. So, you know, the next story that comes down the pike after it's very clear that fossil fuel doesn't cut the mustard, that, you know, dying and decaying dinosaur bones created all the oil on Earth, including tar oil or sand oil, sand tar oil, whatever they call it, and you know, the vast tar deposits that, say, are in Venezuela, or the other more liquid deposits that are in the Mideast, or the vast ocean of liquid oil that's simply at the bottom of the Caspian Sea. Where did all this come from? Well, abiotic oil does not explain any of it, really. How did this all get back up to the surface? Well, nobody can tell you. But then the other thing I want to talk about are space programs. I'm going to include the Chinese space program because they've been in the news lately, but also Russia, Europe, United States. They're all chattering, but hey, this is all about the money. It's not about going into space, believe me. So at any rate, a few comments here. First of all, I thought it was comical. The space agencies are getting so much mileage off this Matt Damon movie, you know, where he gets lost on Mars and he has to survive till they go back and get him, etc. But anyway, one thing that came out of this past week, this was on spaceweather.com, which is a Rothschild-owned Tier 2 baloney information website. They were talking about the radiation factor on Mars of this guy who's Matt Damon, who's stranded on Mars. And it's so anyway, the title of this article is by a guy that claims to be an expert, The Radiation Threat to the Martian being Matt Damon, by a guy named Ron Turner. He's a doctor of physics and distinguished analyst. So at any rate, we'll see if he really knows what he's talking about, and actually he doesn't know what he's talking about. Let me read exactly what he says here, and then I'll pick it apart. Okay, reading from this supposed scholarly article, it says that the author of the book that the movie was made from, Andy Weir, says he does a good job of representing the risks faced by Mark Watney, stranded on Mars. This is in the movie The Martian. But he is silent on the threat of radiation. Not only to Mark, the lost guy, but the crew of Hermes, the spacecraft, as they execute a daring rescue mission that doubles their time in deep space. It says Ron Turner, distinguished analyst at ANSWER, a public service research institute in Virginia. Doggone, doesn't that sound like the CIA? And they've got these disinformation so-called analyst experts that can give you complete baloney. But anyway, this is a good platform to really understand the real issue of space radiation, which is part of leading into this whole discussion of space programs today. Here he says, space radiation comes from two main sources, solar storms and galactic cosmic rays. So right out of the chute, Dr. Ron here has no clue what he's talking about. He doesn't mention the Van Allen belts. Isn't that interesting? He says solar storms are intense, short-lived, and infrequent. Wait a minute, Mark. It depends on when you're in space. When we were back in the Hale-Bopp era, when Hale-Bopp was exciting the sun on a daily basis, discharging the solar capacitor for a period of 6 years, the sun was violent on a daily basis. It was booming out flares like Johnny B. Good. He goes on to say, fortunately for Mark, there weren't any during his mission. How does he know that? If they never discussed it in the movie and never even considered it, how does he know that there weren't any during the mission? And so, anyway, I don't know. It just gets so silly. But I want to use this as a platform about the issue of space radiation. So let's just leave Earth, pretend we're in a space capsule, and we're going to go out into outer space. What are the radiation issues? Well, as soon as you get up to the ionosphere, you are above the protective atmosphere and you have X-ray radiation. We have astronauts who stayed, what was one Russian guy, what did I say? He was up there for 6 years or something, the most recent record. Anyway, he was up there for a long time and, of course, getting space radiation all the time. But this is in low Earth orbit, remember. They don't allow those guys to go up any higher than basic low Earth orbit because as soon as you get into the Van Allen belts, you have a bit of a problem. And here's, I've talked about this before. We think of the Van Allen belts as zones or kind of donut-shaped zones around the equatorial region of Earth where the electrons, relativistic electrons, so these are not just minor high-energy particles. These are relativistic energy particles that are trapped in Earth's magnetic field. And then there's a proton belt that goes the other way. And so that's just simple physics of charged particles moving in a magnetic field, right, in an orbit. And you can calculate the orbit, etc., based on the magnetic field and the charge of these particles and their mass. That's basic physics. But the problem, one of the problems is when you cross through the Van Allen belts, you are directly hit by these particles. When those particles hit anything, and especially metal, they create X-rays. And this is something that the Russians understood very well. You notice that the Russians are not talking about sending any manned people to Mars or to the moon or anything like that. Actually, Russia just started chatting about this with Europe, but I think they understand that having missions like this, it takes some cooperation, but this is all smoke and mirrors for them, too. The real Tier 1 science is international in scope, and so that's one of the things you have to understand, that when the Rothschild banking industry that controls science has their Tier 1 scientists, this is international. It's Russia, it's the United States, and these scientists work internationally with facilities that you don't even know about. And so it's not unusual for, say, astronomers to be working at some of the big facilities in, say, Hawaii or Chile or South America or the South Pole or whatever. And all of a sudden, in come the so-called men in black and scientists, and they just, okay, they have to leave. And so whatever's going on, they do their thing, the Tier 1 scientists, and then they leave, and they don't talk to anybody. So, this goes on in the background. So all of this, you have to understand right up front, that all of this smoke and mirrors that you see is Tier 2 science. And so let's get back to the Dr. Ron Turner here. He says that these high-energy particles that arise from supernovas colliding neutron stars and other violent events happen all the time in the Milky Way. But wait a minute, Ron. Cosmic rays, we see them coming from our very own sun. We see them, cosmic rays, coming from locations above thunderstorms right here on Earth. So this is not, the guy has no idea. He's supposed to be some kind of an expert. He says space radiation comes from two main sources, solar storms and galactic cosmic rays. Like I say, cosmic rays, it's well known now that they come from the sun also. They come from areas above thunderstorms on Earth, including X-rays, even gamma rays, which is a super high energy light, electromagnetic radiation. Okay, so back into the Van Allen belts. Now, there's the region of protons, and then there's the region of electrons. Hey, boys and girls, that's a battery. And that's in outer space, and this is in the plasma environment of outer space, where there is no resistance to electrical current. So why don't they typically discharge? Because they are locked in a magnetic field, co-rotating charged particles, positive charged particles in one direction and negatively charged electrons in the other direction. But what happens if a spacecraft comes through one of them or in the region of one of them and then passes through the other one? What happens? Well, a little problem. It's called an electrical discharge. And so what happens is this is actually even worse because now you're discharging between the two radiation belts. Why does this happen? Because when the spacecraft passes through that region, it acts like the bug in the backyard bug killer, and it zaps. And so you get a super electrical discharge between those two zones, and that's what can create just a burst of radiation, especially primarily x-rays. And by the way, this is exactly when you go to the dentist or you go to the doctor and they give you an x-ray, inside that big plastic head that they move around and they go, okay, no, don't move, and you go and you hear this sound, what is going on inside of there is they're shooting high energy electrons at a metal plate. That's it. That's what causes the x-rays. And then they have a shield around it, so the x-rays only come out in one region. And so that's what an x-ray machine is. That's why the x-rays are created. So you have the exact same thing going on in outer space. And now, just a side note, the argument that a lot of the, let's say, internet Trekkies that try and defend NASA going to the moon, their story about the Van Allen belts is they say, oh, NASA knew about those and they flew around them. Well, let me tell you something, boys and girls. The Apollo spacecraft did not have fuel to go out in one direction and then re-divert itself off to the moon. This would take an extreme amount of fuel. And they didn't have that. They only had enough to retro drop into the moon. So, you know, they talk about this stuff like, oh, yeah, they knew about it. They just kind of flew around the Van Allen belts like you'd fly around a thunderstorm in an airplane on Earth. No, the Apollo lunar module and that whole Apollo module did not have enough fuel to do what they're saying that allegedly happened. Because even though the moon is in somewhat of a tilted orbit, it still is only it's still you have to pass through the Van Allen belts to get directly to the moon, coming and going and coming back. And so once again, their after the fact explanation doesn't hold water. You can't just fly around things. It takes a tremendous amount of extra fuel, and they simply didn't have it. So after 50 years of being in outer space, NASA has no clue what space radiation is all about. And that's just getting out through the Van Allen belts. Now you have to deal with solar storms. And the other issue with solar storms that they don't understand, they're only considering the radiation that comes out from the sun. As, say, you're hit by one of these radiation storms, or say it even misses you, and this happens all the time, I deal with this all the time when I'm talking about Earth weather, a solar flare goes by and it misses us. And they go, oh, gee, it missed us, end of story, goodbye. And then we fly into the path where that solar storm had already passed, moving out away from the sun, and Earth is in its orbit, moving around the sun. All of a sudden, we are in direct line with the discharge of the solar capacitor that's going on due to that solar flare. And this can create severe weather on Earth. And with the spacecraft, the same thing would happen. It would discharge the solar capacitor. So even though you don't get directly hit with a solar flare, it still can affect you with radiation. And now let's go to some place like the surface of Mars. Mars does not have a plasma magnetic field like Earth does. Earth has a magnetic field, and I discussed this last week, the fact that planets with large moons sustain magnetic fields. Why is that? Because that moon is out in the solar wind, it's moving around, it's charged, it's electrically charged, and that's what drives the magnetic field on the planet, on the mother planet. So Mars does not have a large moon. It has two little asteroidal moons, but nothing big like Earth's moon, and that's what gave me rise to discuss the fact that Mars had a large moon in recent times, which is very interesting. Certainly nothing anybody has ever talked about before. But the getting back to radiation, Mars doesn't have a magnetic field, so therefore, here's the problem. And it has a very thin atmosphere. So all of the types of radiation that we're protected from on planet Earth are not there on Mars. So let's go through the laundry list of radiation that the astronaut would have had on Mars, in the Martian. Okay, on Earth, let's look at all the protective aspects of our atmosphere and magnetic field that we have that allow us to live, to go outside in the sun, etc. And remember that if you go up to a mountaintop, the UV radiation is so intense that you literally have to wear almost an aluminum hat and suit to maintain to keep the ultraviolet radiation off of you. And sunscreen is not going to do you a lot of good if you're up in the mountains a lot. That UV radiation is really intense. So, okay, right there, Earth has a thick atmosphere that protects us, that actually blocks ultraviolet. Infrared radiation is very bad for people also. What we've adjusted to on this planet is the radiation that is in the form of visible light. That's the majority of light that actually reaches the ground where we are. Recently, UV radiation has been coming through in larger quantities, and the amount of visible light has actually been reduced. The solar spectrum is actually changing a bit. But okay, let's go up to the upper atmosphere. The upper atmosphere blocks X-rays. Those X-rays are absorbed. And the other thing is that UV radiation is absorbed up in the upper atmosphere. And it basically is one of the contributors to creating ozone, which is another thing that blocks ultraviolet radiation. So when they talk about ozone holes, and somehow they believe that this was recent and due to chlorofluorocarbons, that was a total myth of modern science that caused everybody to change their refrigerants and everything else, and there wasn't a shred of proof to any of that. Another NASA complete fabricated science that had no validity at all. The ozone holes have been going on for centuries and centuries, and they had, of course, no data going back farther than that, but that's another issue, and those are naturally occurring changes in our due to just the upper atmosphere and the way it absorbs ultraviolet light. X-rays, for example, if you were on Venus, which is a very hostile atmosphere, but you can see the X-rays on the planet Venus from a distance, and that's because it doesn't have any shielding magnetic field. So here's another effect. Earth has a magnetic field about 30,000 miles out to the sunward side. We have the solar wind coming in. And the solar wind is a wind of charged particles that come out of the sun. It's there all the time. Sometimes it's more intense during a solar storm. It's very much more intense. But if we have a solar magnetic reversal, something that happens quite regularly in our solar, in our region of Earth, it literally is enough to reverse Earth's magnetic field. And then the solar wind comes pounding in, and actually reaches our upper atmosphere, creating a big wave of X-rays, and this can be dangerous. The Russians have been studying this back into the early 1990s. When I was working with them, that was one of the things they were looking at with the health concerns, and they were actually monitoring health situation in their residents going back into the early 1990s when it was known that the Earth's magnetic field would be reversed. And remember that most of our magnetic field comes from the plasma that's outside of the Earth itself. Actually, a lot of people think that our magnetic field is somehow locked into the Earth itself, and that's simply another myth of modern science. The majority of our magnetic field really comes from plasma. There's electrical currents in the Earth itself, and that's due to the moon being charged, moving around the Earth. The plasma layers in the atmosphere, the jet streams, are ionic and electron streams co-rotating. That contributes to one layer of the magnetic field, etc. Going all the way, there's a five-layer magnetic field. Okay, so at any rate, under normal conditions, our magnetic field, what happens? The protons and electrons come in from the solar wind. The protons go one way, the electrons go another way. They bend in the magnetic field, so it blocks that radiation, that particle radiation from hitting our upper atmosphere, creating X-rays, and basically making life would have to be very different here, because we live in a non-X-ray environment. And so just that little bit of dosage, it's enough to certainly cause, and there's certainly a cancer element that's caused naturally just due to that X-ray influx. And so the question is, can your body deal with that? And there again, cancer typically is dealing with people who have low immune systems. Okay, so at any rate, let's go back to the Martian. Mars does not have a thick atmosphere. Mars does not have a magnetic field. All of the protection that we get from our thick atmosphere, which is really actually pretty thin, if you look on atmospheric standards, our atmosphere is relatively thin. It used to be much thicker. People used to live a much longer lifespan, and the human body was designed to live in a very moist atmosphere. That's why people are always putting lotion. People are putting lotion on because their skin is dry because of modern conditions in a heated environment or air conditioning environment where it's very dry. The best climates on Earth tend to be in semi-tropical areas where you have a temperature between, say, 65 and 85 degrees with a relative humidity of about 20 to 40%. If it gets too much humidity, then it's actually uncomfortable. So it's very clear that the human body developed in an atmosphere that was about those temperatures. They could live around the entire globe, and the atmosphere was much thicker. Before the time of Noah, there were no rainbows. Remember that the rainbow was a phenomenon that occurred after the Noah's flood. So that means our atmosphere changed considerably after the Noah's flood. Prior to that, they talked about a canopy of water around Earth, and that's literally how it was, a very dense, thick atmosphere, etc. Okay, so back to our Martian guy out there stranded on planet Mars. One thing they don't talk about is how cold it gets on the Martian nights. I mean, that would have not have been a very good... But anyway, back to the concept of radiation. The Martian guy would have been exposed to extreme levels of X-rays. When the solar wind does hit the Martian atmosphere, that's one issue. The other issue of extreme ultraviolet light, the fact that cosmic rays come from the sun, not only from interplanetary space, and also the electrical effects of the dust storms. Now, the dust storms in the wind are electrical effects. And so those are issues that even people on the moon would have to deal with. So these are all related to electrical conditions, atmospheric conditions, and the fact that Mars doesn't have a magnetic field. So to say that really only dealing with solar storms and cosmic rays for the Martian, this guy Ron Turner simply, I mean, I don't know what, you know, this guy is a simpleton idiot. He doesn't know what he's talking about at all. I mean, he doesn't even recognize the kind of radiation that we know fully well happens on Earth. If you go in a jetliner and you're up at a high altitude, especially in the northern latitudes, when there's a solar storm, you can get a real good dose of X-rays with a magnetic reversal. And I mean, anyway, enough of that. But this leads also into the topic of the space programs. Just a quick note here, NASA announced that it's using social media. And I don't know about you, but I'm getting bombarded with emails regarding NASA tweeting and other things. But anyway, they started a program, NASA social media program. They have 13 platforms. So that's like YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, you know, whatever, this whole laundry list of social media out there. So they're using 13 of these platforms, like Facebook, etc. And they have 500 accounts, and they have people managing these. So every day you're going to get lambasted with NASA propaganda through social media. And I wonder if social media will eventually fail just because of the overuse, especially if the government agencies get into the act, starting to try to influence your thought patterns. Okay, I'm going to switch gears here just a little bit before I get into the space race, the space agency programs. This is very interesting that 10 states in the United States, 10 states are considering the gold standard for, have already introduced and in legislation. Three have passed legislation, Utah, South Carolina, and now Colorado. And that Colorado actually did this last February, where they've passed legislation to go on to the gold standard, and they're getting ready for basically what they say in the legislation is the catastrophic failure of the Federal Reserve banking system. Now, remember that the Federal Reserve has nothing to do with federal. There's no reserve about it because they don't have any, it's pure fiat money. It was started in 1913. And I'm not going to go into that, but it's interesting to understand the level of movement towards gold standard. Singapore has gone on to the gold standard, and it's created basically by doing that the center of banking worldwide. The BRICS nations are purchasing gold and putting it into reserve. In fact, the banks in the United States are actually taking their gold off of reserves, off of available status, and putting it into reserve status. I've talked to that before, because they're positioning themselves to have all the gold, whereas the claims to availability of gold for the average guy out there who purchased gold, paper gold that is it went from about 10 to 1 to 283 to 1 in the last couple of weeks, simply because they've removed the availability of gold. And prior to that, it was around 10 to 1. So if you went and wanted to get your gold, they're going to go, oh, yeah, fill out this form, and you'll get it in maybe 12 to 24 months, if you're lucky, buddy. You know, don't call us, we'll call you. But Carrot Bars is in a perfect position to so people can start accumulating golds. And I won't say any more about that because it's on my webpage. But this whole issue of monetary standards worldwide is in such flux. Recently, the dollar is crashing worldwide. It's coming down where it had doubled over a 8-month period from around November to around July is when it peaked. Doubling in value against third world currencies. That was designed to destroy the middle class and the upper middle class of these countries that were basically the merchants, the ones not related to military or other government spending programs, but the merchants, and it has successfully done that. So now they're bringing the dollar back down and making it a horribly, horribly dangerous place to travel in the world today if you're an American. Okay, so that... just also want to mention Via Viente, just quickly. It's on my webpage. You take a couple ounces of this in the morning and the evening. It's a concentrated drink that has minerals, vitamins, enzymes, and a very heavy antioxidant. And it's really good for you. It's the food in the United States especially is terrible. It doesn't looks nice, but it has no food value at all. So more and more people are taking Via Viente for their health. Okay, so on to the, by the way, listen at the end of the program. I have an announcement about some new programs that I have underway. And just a little note here. I got a negative comment from a listener saying, oh, I don't like your advertisements, you know, or something like that. You do too many. I don't do any advertisements. You don't hear... you know, advertisements for anything. You listen to any other radio show on the planet, you're stopping every 3 minutes for 10 minutes of advertising. I don't have any of that. I pay for my own airtime. But the things that I do are for your benefit. Carrot bars, Via Viente, these are things that, you know, when it comes right down to it, I don't make that much money off of it. But this is for your benefit out there, everybody. And this is for literally everybody, from kids. There are people who are setting up Carrot Bars accounts for their kids because they want their kids to have a college education. They're not putting their money into the bank to try and pay for college. They're putting it into Carrot Bars. And that's because I'm putting this out there in front of them. They have that option. So at any rate, when you listen to me talking here, the reality is I don't make that much off of this stuff. This is for your benefit. When I talk about space programs or the wing generator, which, by the way, is doing quite well, it's going to be commercialized. I don't know when the first one's going to roll off the assembly line, but it's not going to be that long now. And so, and by the way, when it comes to the wing generator, I did my fundraising, my Indiegogo fundraiser. I was asking for $50,000. I got 12 out of that. And believe me, I'm putting a lot of my own money into that to make it happen. So there again, I'm doing a lot of this stuff for your benefit. The wing generator eventually is going to get a lot of people off the grid. And eventually when we start building the big ones, it's going to get a lot of you out there off of the grid and away from paying these unreasonable electric bills. Plus, you're going to be able to power your electric car with wind power. You know, so these things that I'm doing are for your benefit. I hope you understand that. And then when I talk about space radiation, etc., I want you to know that the space programs, whether it's in Russia, China, or the United States, are bogus. These are bogus, and they're asking you to pay for it for 10, 20, 30 years of complete nonsense. And there again, things that I do in the background are positioning so that someday your kids will actually have a real space program that they can use, go into outer space, and become children of the stars. And that's their birthright, and it's being kept from them by the idiots at NASA, the CIA, who only wants, who are the police force of the World Bank, who are preventing you from having your life. You know, the garbage they post on spaceweather.com or space.com or space.com, you know, or weather.com, all of these owned and manipulated information sources, not to mention CNN and Discover Magazine and all these other glossy magazines. Okay, enough of that. But understand what I'm doing here very much is for your benefit. Okay, on to the topic of abiotic oil. Now, I got a kick out of this. There's nobody that pushed the concept of peak fuel and fossil fuels more than NASA. And so when it became obvious, they started visiting other planets, other moons in the solar system, and they're finding vast amounts of methane and natural gas and oil. Comets are covered with tar. It's just incredible. As I pointed out in the beginning of my book, The Diamond Principle, they're finding oil deposits, 18,000 feet under the surface of the Gulf of Mexico in these huge, huge deposits. That was the cause of the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, as they tapped into one of these babies and the pressure was so high they couldn't contain it. It blew the piping apart, and then it started polluting the Gulf of Mexico. It's still polluting there, and they could have cleaned that up, but they didn't. But anyway, that's another story. So anyway, all of a sudden, NASA comes out and says, oh, fossil fuel isn't correct. It didn't come from dinosaur bones or fern forests that decayed or whatever. Now, they don't even talk about coal or where that came from. So at any rate, after discovering oceans of methane and natural gas and oil, etc., all over the solar system, including that it's on the moon, they had to come out with something else. And so this kind of slid in the side, and they're claiming that Russia has been proving this for decades about abiotic oil, where the Russians know very well, because I used to work with them. They know very well that the oil comes from comets, but they're trying to, they always do this. They say, oh, the Russians said it. You know, what Russians? I'd like to know what Russians talked about abiotic oil. But they have published papers, just like in the United States, about oil supposedly forming thousands of feet underground in heavy pressure, that somehow rocks turn into oil. Well, let me tell you something. Even if it happened, let's play devil's advocate, you're not going to get down there and get it. But the other thing is, the little bit of what they believe is abiotic oil, in other words, non-biological oil, that's what the term literally means. It was started by a guy named Thomas Gold. When I was at Cornell University, Tommy Gold was a big guy there, big name, but very much against the standard scientific community on many topics, including the concept that oil was from fern forests. Tommy Gold was an advocate of that. Back in my early work in the 1970s, remember that Velikovsky had identified oil as coming from comets. He didn't know how it happened. He just knew that the ancients talked about the burning brimstone and fire, the naphtha and brimstone coming in from the upper atmosphere that rained in and burned as it came into the atmosphere. And so what my work did was found the physical scientific basis for that, the hydrocarbons forming in the carbon in the comet tails. And when we pass through a comet tail, we get drenched with oil. And so at any rate, that's why you would find, I'm sure they're going to find oil on Mars, down in the crust of Mars, because Mars, like every other planet, is going to eventually, in its history, would have passed through a comet tail. And so when just recently, comet sighting spring passed Mars, Mars grew its atmosphere quite a bit, and with some clearly some trace elements that they could trace back to the comet tail. So very clearly that concept is true, but of course standard science cannot acknowledge that, because then this opens up the entire door of Velikovsky again. Every time they take a turn, Velikovsky pops up again and was correct. So anyway, going back to this idea of abiotic oil, and I know there's people, I'm on radio shows with other people, and they're somehow convinced that abiotic oil is real. Okay, well, the oil that was first discovered in the Mideast back in the 1200s, when they first started refining oil, getting kerosene out of it, getting other types of extracts out of it, and they understood even about plastics back then, some of the different ways to refine oil and get other materials out of it. came from back in the when the Arabs discovered it. In those days, it was literally laying around in pools on the desert. And they'd collect it, and they'd learned how to create fires. And one of the first primary uses, of course, was for warfare, where they'd put a big ball of either hemp rope or, let's say, just grass and dried grass or shoots of biological material, and they'd soak it in oil and then bundle it all together. You see this, for example, in the movie, all the old movies, like the movie Troy was a good example where they used these. And there's just that's one of the standard things they always use in the old movies, is they either throw them off of a castle wall, they had like catapults, and they throw these big bundles of burning oil, and of course they throw them into the castle, and the guys in the castles would be throwing them out, etc. So the use of oil was first for warfare, and then when they began reading it, it would be used for gifts for kings, international trade, etc., and then the rest is history. But where does oil come from? It comes from comet tails. Boy, they just cannot get around the corner to get to the right answer. They just, you know, they will not allow the real answer to that question, where does oil come from? It comes from our Earth passing through large comet tails. We're not talking about Halley's Comet or little poofball comets. We're talking about the big comets that do come through the solar system actually somewhat regularly. And of course, this is the whole topic of Planet X, the many Planet X objects. There is so much misinformation out there, but that's why NASA had to switch gears and start talking about abiotic oil. It's a non-answer that can switch gears and keep the real truth from the public. Very simple. This also goes along with that complete baloney about ringwoodite. They found one little rock that's the size of your thumbnail. This whole thing about ringwoodite is based on a rock about the size of your thumbnail that came from a diamond mine region in Africa. And they go, oh, this must have come up with the diamonds. They don't even know why there's diamonds in these regions. They say it's due to movement coming up from deep regions of the earth. But it's so stupid, because how could a diamond form under severe pressure deep in the earth's core when it's surrounded by softer rock? I mean, does this make any sense at all? Absolutely not. Another fairy tale science theory. Diamonds literally come from outer space, and we know this. They've actually seen stars with rings of diamonds around them, and they also understand that I've talked about this before, that diamonds form from the discharges, the electrical discharges in comets. Going back to some laboratory experiments, they take vaporized carbon. So this is just carbon atoms in a vapor, send an electrical current of electrons into it, and they form balls and mini diamonds. The mastodons up in the Alaska rivers, they found the bones there, and these mastodons are just dead, some of them all broken apart because of the tremendous washes and floods that were going on at the time. But the part of the bones, etc., that are up facing upwards are just peppered with what they call micro diamonds. These are extremely, extremely small diamonds. And the lower side has none at all, which means they were peppered after they died and the bones were exposed. And so these micro diamonds are buried into the bones. So they were coming in at high velocity from outer space. Those are formed in the electrical discharges on the nose side of comets, because you have carbon and you have electron beam. Hey, just exactly like in the vacuum chambers on Earth in the experiments. So at any rate, very important to understand where oil comes from and all of the misinformation that's going to come to you. Now they're saying, well, the idea of peak oil is over, because now there's abiotic oil, and that accounts for the oil on the surface of the Earth. But wait a minute. If this oil is forming, you know, 20 to 400 miles under the surface of the Earth, then how does it get up here? It's, once again, it doesn't answer the question. It doesn't answer where all the surface oil of Earth comes from. Anyway, another diversion onto the topic of space programs. Okay, so recently China has come out in the news saying it's going to, it had a meeting just recently, and it had told its scientists, get ready, we're going into outer space. This is going to be a national pride type program, kind of like the old Apollo program in the United States. You know, get your thinking caps on. But when it comes right down to the rubber meeting the road, it's all talk. Now, China does have a relatively advanced space program. They've had equipment in orbit. They have a satellite system that can take out our satellite system in an afternoon. And basically, it's a shrapnel type of shotgun type of product. They basically release large quantities of just shrapnel, you know, bolts and nuts and whatever, shot. In that moving at high speed, hitting a satellite, there's no satellite in existence that's going to withstand that kind of an onslaught. Okay, so let's start talking about the actual space programs. First, I'll annotate this with the U.S. program. Really, the United States does not have a lot going on right now. They're talking about going to Mars in 20 years. They're getting a lot of leverage off of this Matt Damon movie. They're bypassing any lunar bases, they say, although we know that there's been a lot of activity there with the Tier 1 science. But what I'm talking about here is the Tier 2 science that you're going to hear a lot about in the news. But the U.S. wants to go directly to Mars. I'll also preface this by saying that landing on a planet with the major expedition is a stupid idea. When we went to the moon, we should have never gone to the moon to land on it. And that just tells me that this wasn't a real program to begin with in the first place. Because what you would simply do, and what the Russians did, is they just sent a guy around the moon to orbit the moon, swing around, and come back. Not a big deal. But the problem was, is the guy came back completely French fried, because then they discovered the problem with space radiation, something that still exists today. So the Chinese are debating whether they should go into space with a manned mission. Manned missions take about 10 to 100 times the resources and give back not that proportionate amount of effort, but if you're going to go into space, what's the point unless there's a manned mission involved someplace down the line? Primarily, we want to get the man into space and living and learn how to live in space. But you're never going to do this by sending one person or four people or something like that. So China is talking about four people to the moon maybe in 20 years. They're going to send robots to the moon to do some exploration. There's a lot of concentration around the south pole of the moon because people think there's water there, because it could be frozen there, and that could be used for fuel, for water, for other uses. Water is one of the very basic elements that we need here on Earth. You can split it apart using electrolysis into hydrogen and oxygen. That's the primary fuel that's going to be used in outer space for chemical rockets, which is, by the way, not a great way to go into outer space. I've developed other ways of going into outer space, electromagnetic propulsion systems, and that's the way to travel around the planets, around the solar system, etc. But at any rate, the United States, between Russia, Europe, United States, and China, I would say that the U.S. is probably third on the list behind Europe. And Britain doesn't even show up on the map here at all. They've had quite a few failures. They tried to get to Mars about four times, never succeeded with any of them, but I think they had a little help from the CIA there, who operates a lot of the space programs. Remember that the CIA is in charge of NASA. I've talked about that. If you need more information on that, go to my July 23rd release on the Hale-Bopp Planet X Harrington Expedition update. But at any rate, so the United States can basically put out this program that's going to take 20 years. They can depend on the Matt Damon movie saying, look at what we're going to do. We're going to be just like this, but in 20 years. So it's really a non-program. It's there to eat up the money. It's the, but remember, don't worry about all the money that NASA's spending. It's just fiat paper money anyway. It's a ledger in a computer somewhere off in, who even knows where the computer is. Doesn't matter. But China is talking about getting serious. I would expect China really to pull ahead in the space race. Number one, they have the commitment to do it. Number two, it doesn't take money. Remember, I gave a talk, this was back in 2003, I believe, in front of about 1,200 people, and a lot of them NASA scientists and government scientists at that meeting, and I said, "It don't look in terms of money, but the U.S. space program always looks in terms of money. You have to look in terms of resources. If you broke down a NASA budget, let's say it was like a unit of 100. About 95% of that goes to overhead, administrative salaries, insurance, retirement accounts. 95% goes to those kind of things. It doesn't go to the science. Then you take that 5% that's left over, and a lot of that goes into testing and trying to get maybe new types of technologies incorporated into the space program. So you're down to about possibly 1% that actually goes to the science, and that actually includes salaries of people who are scientists on the mission, etc. Maybe 1 to 5%. Let's be generous. Give them 5%. So say a $300 million program, let's say about $15 million of that actually goes to pay salaries of scientists that work on it, but for the actual equipment, which is very little. Now let's take a country like China that has resources and can put those resources to work. And remember, China can go out and buy space technology. They bought the rockets from Russia. They bought the docking technology from Russia. That's something that the U.S., remember, spent all of the Gemini program was, that was a, the whole Gemini program was about. The pre-Apollo program was called Gemini. That's what it was all about. Remember the Mercury program, then Gemini, the precursor to Apollo. That's what it was all about, learning how to dock and maneuver in outer space. And then, of course, Apollo did a bunch of the maneuvers, etc., in learning how to dock, etc., in Earth orbit. It's kind of a tricky maneuver because when you accelerate, it's not like on Earth. You don't just kind of go up to the next guy. You have to direct your acceleration below the person because you're going to move into a higher orbit simply by accelerating. But China just went out and bought this. So instantly they had the technology that took other countries decades to develop. So China has that ability, and they can go out and snap up this technology and remote sensing or whatever they need. So developing a space program today is much simpler than it used to be. Also, we have reduced miniature technology in terms of equipment, things like that. A lot of that is off the shelf, so it's much easier for a country like China to jump into the space race now than ever before. But also China has resources, and they don't have the vast Western-style corporation overhead. So this makes China a player that has to be dealt with, because now, more than ever, the United States has to deal with these humongous bills that go along with any development. You know, the aerospace companies have to make their share, and they're all in line, and Congress has got to fund it, because if not, they're not going to get elected, on and on and on. And so that brings up a little side note. It's a good time to throw this in now. There's a book that just came out. It's entitled, Why Is It So Hard to Go Back to the Moon? And then my question is, what do you mean go back? There's no proof that NASA ever went there in the first place. And it's the burden of proof is on NASA, not on me to prove that they didn't go. The proof is on NASA. They've never proven that they've gone there. They have zero proof. They've got some lunar orbiter pictures that look like pencil scratching on the back of a notepad and some overexposed blotches on a few pixels on a photograph. It's nothing. They don't have a shred of proof that they went to the moon at all. But anyway, that's an aside note. And this book blames it on Congress and politics. Well, in the George Bush Jr. administration, he gave NASA carte blanche and a lot of money to go back and start a moon program. And he wanted, by the end of the decade where he was president, he wanted another lunar landing so he could pretend like he was John Kennedy. Well, excuse me, but George Bush Jr. ain't going to ever be a John Kennedy in brains or in any other capability. But NASA played around with that for about 6 years, and all they ever came up with was some pretty artist drawings, not a shred of development at all. So when Obama came along, he just dumped the whole program, which he should have. I mean, I don't agree with very much that Obama does, but that I did agree with. In fact, he should dump NASA completely. But anyway, back to these programs. China is talking about a manned mission to deep space. Okay, that's great, but just remember that any spacecraft out there is going to be discharging the solar capacitor. Electrical discharges in outer space are very real, and they do happen, and that's why comets work the way they work, because they're discharging the solar capacitor. And if you look at Pluto, for example, just recently, as far out and away from the sun as it is, it's being heated because of Joule heating, electrical discharge that far from the sun. And so no matter where you go, you're going to have to deal with this and all of the radiation that goes with it. So radiation is the top ticket here, the thing that you really have to solve, and they have not solved it. I just want to make an announcement here also. I have a new project that's coming. You'll have to visit my webpage to understand the details of this because it's too complex to really discuss on the air. And basically, I'm going outside of my audience, my standard audience, for support on this. But you'll be able to read about this. And actually, a number of announcements coming up, too many to announce on this show, coming up in the near future. And these are projects that are going public in a very wide variety. And if you look at these projects that I'm exposing to the public now, these are all related to living here a comfortable life on Earth, and also targeted towards basically a private space program in which we'll eventually be going into outer space. So that's something that's very much on my radar and will be including you, my listeners, and a much wider audience out there too. So go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.